Have you noticed that people are using the phrase recently, that sounds like a first world problem? It's an indication of the things that we find frustrating or annoying, like having to scrape ice off the windshield, I guess, in our affluent culture, but that are generally not issues at all in poorer parts of the world. Our guests today left the first world behind and went to be of help in other parts of the world with a stint in the Peace Corps. They tell the story, or two stories actually, in their joint memoir, which is actually his and hers memoirs in a single package, 300 Cups of Tea and The Toughest Job, subtitled Riding the Peace Corps Roller Coaster in Mali, West Africa. The authors are Asifa Kanji, who was born in Tanzania, grew up there and in Kenya, went to school in England, and came to America more than 40 years ago. David Drury was a university lecturer and a social scientist, putting the sciences to work in the field in many countries. He's also been a truck driver, a census taker, and a London busker, among other things. David Drury and Asifa Kanji, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us over.
How did the two of you meet?
That's a whole hour in itself. Basically, I was working as a busker in London and doing my first pieces of research. And I was one of the pieces of research had to do with squatting, taking over empty houses. Asifa was working with International Voluntary Service at the time, and she was running a work camp for volunteers on this side of the street. I was on the other side of the street. It was August 1974, and Nixon was about to resign. An Australian friend came in and said, David, Nixon's resigned. Well, it wasn't quite true, but this being 1974, I ran across the street and up the stairs to see, because they had the radio on there, to see what was going on. And there was this very skinny Indian girl cooking a big pot of stew for the volunteers.
And that was Asifa.
That was me, and he stayed a while, a long while.
Can't get him out of the house yet. I get the sense from the acknowledgments that you two had to be convinced to make a book. What was the genesis of the material that became the book?
One of the traditions that I have had is to write letters in all the places we've lived and worked in. Once a month, I write an epistle, if you may want to call it that, and it's an essay on whatever it is that I found interesting or that might be interesting to people back home. And those letters get photocopied, they get emailed, they get sent, and there's quite a circulation of that going on. And everybody says, oh, we love your writing, you must write. And so this book we specifically wrote as a fundraiser, because I'm sure you let people know that we were evacuated from Mali very suddenly because of the coup, which meant we couldn't say goodbye, we couldn't say thank you. And so this is our way of saying thank you. Every penny that goes from the sales of this book will be returned back to Mali for grassroots projects.
It is a little hard to describe it as a book or books, because it really is two books consecutively, Asifa with 300 Cups of Tea and David with The Toughest Job. Did you consider other formats, like alternate chapters or something?
Well, in the earliest drafts, we had the two chapters interleaved, and then various people that we gave the drafts out to said, no, your styles are jarringly different. You had a lot of experiences that overlapped, but you write about them so differently, it really makes more sense to do Asifa's in one place and mine in the other place.
So there was something that you let us know about Asifa in your book, The 300 Cups of Tea, some advice that your mother gave you that stuck. What was that?
You have to do for other people. You must serve. Service is the most important thing in life. It's the only purpose God will accept.
So you have to do for others.
You have to do for others.
But the two of you in the Peace Corps was a later in life thing, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I was 58. David was 60 when we left. But doing for others is something you do all your life anyway. This was our way of saying thank you to the world. It was our way of having an incredible adventure. And hey, you know, if you're going to have an adventure, it's much more fun if you can do good rather than do bad.
So what were some of the things you did before the Peace Corps?
In terms of doing for others, mm-hmm. or earning money? Doing for others, I've worked for hospice in Hilo. I have run work camps on immigrant people in this country on how to assimilate into this culture. I've taught English anywhere and Oh, whatever sounds like fun and new and interesting, I'm there. I'm in it for the experience. I have to say that I'm not really a Mother Teresa with a halo on my head.
So the decision to go to the Peace Corps apparently started with you. And then, David, what was the first thing out of your mouth?
First thing out of my mouth was, it's much more fun to be a do-gooder than a do-badder. Why not?
Really?
Yeah.
You were that embracing of it?
We both had worked overseas for many years but got paid for it. But my work had always involved no more than 6 months in a place. And at the end of my career, I thought, it would be nice to actually be in one place for a very, very long time.
Is it true that you included a New Yorker cartoon with your application for the Peace Corps?
I did indeed, and maybe some of your older listeners will remember it. It was the old-style baseball scoreboard, you know, with inning one, two, three, four, uh-huh. five. And it was the game between the idealists and the realists. And the realists were scoring one run, two runs, four runs. And in each inning, the idealists, it was 0-0, 0-0. Final score? Realist 0, idealist 1. At the end, you got something.
Did it register on the people of the Peace Corps? Were they impressed by that?
They took us on.
All right. We'll learn more about how as we go further into the conversation with David Drury and Asif Akanji. They wrote side-by-side memoirs in one cover, 300 Cups of Tea by Asifa and The Toughest Job by David. And we'll come back and talk more with them. On the way to the break, let me let you know again that this is Fall Fun to Drive Time on Jefferson Public Radio. We're asking for your support. We keep public radio on the air the way you've come to know it. By your pledges of support, we're getting very close to $52,000 now on our way to $190,000. It's New Member Friday. You come in as a new member at the $45 membership rate. Peter Sage, a longtime contributor to JPR, puts in $45 out of his own pocket. No kidding. He's ready to write a check for 100, 150 new members, whatever it takes. And you can call that pledge into 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Back with Asifa and David and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today with a couple of Ashland residents about their experience in the Peace Corps in Mali in West Africa. They wrote side-by-side memoirs in one cover, 300 Cups of Tea by Asif Akanji and The Toughest Job by David Drury, subtitled Riding the Peace Corps Roller Coaster in Mali, West Africa. You've already heard about part of the roller coaster, at least the end part of the ride, when they had to be evacuated because of a coup in Mali. Many more details to pick up along the way. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Perhaps you had Peace Corps experiences. You'd like to share some stories with us as well. We'd like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. As you pointed out in your book, The Toughest Job, David, the Peace Corps does take older people, but what are the expectations?
Well, the most important thing is you have to be healthy. In places like Mali, you're going to be 12 hours from the nearest competent medical care, and sometimes more. And so they love people who have experience. And also, to be honest, having gray hair in West Africa is really important. People will listen to you in a way that they won't listen to a 23-year-old.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's a big difference culturally then. So people with gray hair are not marginalized as they can be sometimes in Western culture.
No, not a bit. They're respected.
Huh.
And you hopefully have the experience to match your gray hair. So
what was homecoming like? Then you come back to America and it's like, oh, there's that geezer again going on about that stuff.
Actually, I haven't seen anything like that. That Ashland is a place that is full of amazingly accomplished, type A, interesting people.
Asifa, there was another obstacle for you apparently in getting into the Peace Corps. What was that? Citizenship.
Oh, yes, I forgot. I've lived here for 40 years, but somehow I've resisted taking on American citizenship. But, you know, after 40 years, it felt right. The right president was in power, and I wanted to join the Peace Corps. And so, yes, I went in and took the test. I probably, at that time, knew all the answers to the American civics tests. I'm not sure I could reproduce them right now, but
So you indicated with the Peace Corps that you were a preference for warm countries. So what was the first offer that was made, though?
Was it Ukraine? Yes.
Ukraine.
They called at 5 in the morning, Hawaii time, because that's where we were living at the time. And they said, we've got 2 places for you in Ukraine. You have to say yes now. And we looked at each other, Ukraine? Do we have other choices? What do we do now? And basically we were advised, take it, because then you're on the Peace Corps list and things change because, you know, we have to go through medicals, we have to go through a whole lot of stuff. So if you do not qualify or it takes long time to qualify, you'll miss the Ukraine boat, but there'll be other boats that you can go on.
Are the medical things you need to do to get ready for a country different from country to country? I mean, I think in Ukraine we'd have to worry about malaria, for example.
No. Well, there's nothing you can do about malaria other than take prophylaxis. What they do is they want your complete medical history. Everything that was ever wrong with you, every tablet that you've ever taken, because Peace Corps does support you medically 100%. And if you are out in the middle of nowhere, they want to make sure that they have your entire history. They know what medications you need or don't need, and they can get you to the right help should you need it, should an emergency come up.
Right, so no surprises, as you mentioned, David, right. 12 hours away from medical care. Give us an idea, David, what was happening in the world at large at the time that you were about to embark on your Peace Corps journey?
Oh, dear. Well, Mali lives in a very rowdy neighborhood. I mean, there are one of the biggest problems was the, if people remember the Arab Spring of 2011, there were revolts and demonstrations all across North Africa. And one of the things that affected Mali most was the toppling of Colonel Gaddafi. And there is a Berber group, the Tuaregs, who live in the north of Mali. And even since the 60s, they've been wanting some kind of separate state. When Gaddafi finally went down with American and French help, the Tuaregs seized caches of heavy weapons. And later on, they moved, during our service, they moved south. And by 2012, they were in Mali with heavy weapons. And so it was a turbulent time to be there. Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb was very active. In fact, the French, in the first months of our service, shut down their volunteer program. We don't know exactly why they did that. But that was something that sent a shot across the bow, I suppose.
So this was the backdrop as you were arriving in Mali.
Gaddafi was toppled some months after we came, but this whole situation was developing at the time we were there.
Mm-hmm. So I still haven't gotten how we got from Ukraine posting to Mali. How did that happen, Asifa?
I'm not sure what the inner workings of Peace Corps are. That's still a mystery as to how they assign. But yes, we missed the Ukraine boat because it took a while to get all our medicals finished because we are older and yeah, we have issues like a lot of older people do, and they needed to check that out. But out of the blue, we got a call just before Thanksgiving to say, how good is your French? And I'm thinking, okay, which Eastern country in Europe speaks French? And then the penny dropped. Oh, my goodness, they're going to send us to West Africa. And I don't know how good my French was at the time, but when I answered it, yes, it's very good. It's very good.
Asifa Kanji and David Drury are the authors of side-by-side memoirs of their time in the Peace Corps, 300 Cups of Tea by Asifa and The Toughest Job by David. So what were you supposed to do there, David, in Mali?
Well, Asifa was assigned as a health and nutrition volunteer. All Peace Corps volunteers have what they call a sector. It's basically a type of job you do. And volunteers will do many, many things. You may start a girls' soccer team, but your service, your main job, is according to your sector. I was a small business development volunteer. And so my job, they assigned me in a town to the far west of Kai to work with the local equivalent of JPR, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. It was called Radio Rural de Kai, and it broadcasts for about 100 kilometers around the town of Kai, mostly to farmers, in about 4 languages.
Really? Mm-hmm. I mean, and there seems to be quite a proliferation of languages in Mali.
Mali has over 60 languages.
Really?
The main one is Bambara, the one that we learned. And that's spoken as a native language by about only 30% of the population. Another 50% kind of sort of can get by in it. So it's the lingua franca. French is the official language, but less than 10% of the people actually speak it.
Really? Oh, wow. So that's quite a polyglot of stuff. And were there real issues in making yourself understood with people, Asifa?
Yes, always. We're not as good at learning languages as we like to think we were. I always thought of myself as a language sponge, but it is getting harder as I get older. So you get up to speak and bits of French and bits of Hindi and bits of all the other languages. So my brain's divided in two. English language, all other foreign languages. So yes, but you know, people are very tolerant. They want to communicate. They want to get to know you. And so between pantomime and using words from here, there, and everywhere, you make friends. You laugh a lot.
So there's a section in 300 Cups called Potty Training 101. Explain the significance of that.
Well, on our very first night when we arrived in Bamako, we were asked to gather for our first lesson in how to survive in Mali. And I thought, oh, this is where we get to learn how to deal with snakes and scorpions. No, this was potty training. And what it is there's a hole in the ground that you have to learn to use, squat down on and use. Now, this hole is not big enough to, can I say it on radio? To pee and poop on.
Okay, yeah, those words are fine on the radio.
At the same time. So, yes, there were 60 new volunteers learning by trial and error how to use this little hole in the ground. It had a few consequences.
Okay, we need to go too far into the error here thing. Mm. But so there were also, obviously, in any culture that you haven't been around, there are some cultural protocols to learn around things like meals. There's quite a... quite a to-do about meals, I guess, in native Mali culture. Is that right?
Yes, there is. People eat out of a common pot. There's just one pot, usually piled high with rice, and on the very top there is some sauce and maybe one or two pieces of meat if it's a wealthy family, or usually a piece of vegetable. Women eat out of one pot. Men eat out of a separate pot. The oldest person always starts first. If you're a visitor, you're asked to start first. You don't have to talk during the meal. You stop when you're full and you get up and you go away. You don't have to wait for everyone else to finish. You only eat from your portion of the pot. And if there is a piece of meat or a piece of vegetable on the top, you just break off a small bit. Usually the host will push something towards you if they want you to have a little more. Often they'll do that for children. Here, have a little more piece. But no child or anybody else would be that presumptive to just take the whole piece.
Even if it's in your portion of the pot?
Well, you take a little bit at a time, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very polite. There isn't, you know, people are very, very poor. So two tiny pieces of meat, I mean, you're talking two bite-sized pieces of meat, is going to feed everybody around the pot.
One of the biggest no-nos in Malian eating, because of course you eat with your hand, and almost everyone is Muslim, is eating with the left hand. Absolute no-no. Unfortunately, I am very left-handed, so it was a real challenge for me to retrain my brain to eat with my hand, with my right hand.
The left hand is used for sanitation.
The left hand is used for sanitation. In fact, Malian traditional clothing doesn't even have a left-hand pocket, because why would you put such a foul thing, your left hand, in your pocket?
Wow. That's it's a tough place to be left-handed then.
It is indeed.
Asifa Kanji and David Drury went to Mali in West Africa with the Peace Corps and wrote side-by-side memoirs in a single cover. 300 Cups of Tea is Asifa's work, and The Toughest Job is David's work. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, and your own stories perhaps about service overseas, welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So obviously, cultural mores to get used to, creature comforts, sanitation. Talk about the people. What are the people like in Mali? And then the 300 cups of tea probably is a great clue to what you got to do to get to know people.
Yeah. The people are some of the kindest, the most beautiful, the most generous, the most loving people I have ever, ever, ever met. They have nothing, yet they give everything. I mean, literally, they will share their last grain of rice with you. If you're a visitor, it doesn't matter. The first thing that you're told when they meet you and they know you from overseas or away from home is you may have left home, but you have come home. That is part of the ritual greeting, but they mean it. They really do. They're very easy, peaceful, peace-loving people. They laugh. One of the things, parts of the greetings is called joking cousins. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of joking that goes on right in the greeting. First thing they do is to find out what's your last name. Mm-hmm. If you have a Malian last name, which every Peace Corps volunteer does, if you have the same last name as they do, oh, they congratulate you on your parentage. You know, you're the greatest. You're wonderful. Here, my sister, take some extra mangoes. I mean, this could be the lady at the market. Mm-hmm. But if your name is a different last name, like David was a Koulibaly, I was a Jara, and I can tell you much about Koulibalys because I live with one. These guys eat beans, sit around, fart around all day. And so they pile on friendly abuse on each other. And, you know, they do this ritual 50 times a day, every day. But each time they laugh and, you know, the ice is beyond broken. It's melted. I don't think there's any conflict that can't be solved with the right bean-eating joke.
I mean, picture a culture where for certain kinds of people, everyone is assigned some last names, and these have been your joking cousins, arch enemies since birth. Picture a world where you can be unbelievably rude to certain kinds of people every day. And as long as you stay within the bounds of tradition, it's never genuinely nasty. But just think of the joy of being able to be rude to people and get away with it.
So how much did you two get into the tradition, given that you had some your own language shakiness?
One of the things that Peace Corps does as Asifa said, everyone gets a name, usually from your host family during boot camp, during the homestay in village. And so since you have a last name, you automatically inherit the joking cousins of everyone with your last name. And even with our Bambara, basic Bambara, you joke with people. In fact, it makes marketing, buying things at the market, take twice as long. Because to buy that tomato, you first have to find out what's the jamu or last name of the person. And if they are a joking cousin, then you go through the whole, you eat beans. No, I eat meat. Oh, so you eat donkey, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And this makes marketing take a long time.
Yeah, I noticed the donkey jokes in there. Are donkeys considered unclean or otherwise just bad eating or something?
Mali has the saddest donkeys in the world. They are overworked little beasts, and no one but the most desperate would eat a donkey. And it's an insult.
So you were separated for a time when you first arrived in Mali, is that right?
Yes. Part of the language training is, well, actually all the training is done in village. It's on-site training and you're assigned to different families where you live with the family and learn the cultural mores locally. You get to practice your language with them. They hardly speak any English. Well, they don't speak any English at all. Maybe a little bit of French if they had any education. And so for that period, for those 8 or 9 weeks, yes, we did live separately with separate families just so that we wouldn't then indulge in English, that we could have the same immersion practice.
And how effective was it, David?
Oh, Bambara is a very, very different language from English.
I couldn't even quite make out the way you were expressing it in the book.
I had to use their own script. Mm-hmm. They use the International Phonetic Alphabet to make sure that they capture all the letters. Although I'll say one thing about Bambara as opposed to French or English, it's completely phonetic. I could read a book in Bambara to you, and if you were a native speaker, I might not understand anything that I was saying, but you'd understand the whole thing. So that's something. In fact, I pity the Malian students Bambara speakers who have to learn English or French because it's opaque.
Yeah, a lot of tricky stuff in English. Talk about settling into a rhythm at work once you guys were established in your job and what that was like.
Rhythm at work. Well, one of the main Peace Corps principles is that people should be able to do things for themselves. You don't give them a fish, you give them a fishing rod. So most of our training was to enable them to enable other people. And once you get better and better at the language, I used French at work because I could. I could get a lot further in professional things. Also, I did a lot of computer and technical things for the radio and the Cyber Cafe, and there's no such thing as that in any of the African languages. So French is the one that you use.
Okay. Much more to talk about with David Drury and Asifa Kanji, their joint memoirs, 300 Cups of Tea and The Toughest Job Under a Single Cover. And we'll come back and talk to them in a few moments. Want to let you know on the way to this break, once again, it is Fall Fund Drive time on Jefferson Public Radio. We're seeking your support. Convert your listenership into ownership. We're getting close to $52,000 on our way. We hope to $190,000 by the time all is said and done on Tuesday. It is New Member Friday. You come in as a new member of JPR at the $45 membership level. Our friend Peter Sage puts in $45 out of his own pocket, and voila, your contribution has become $90. Please take advantage of it. 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. And thank you, and we'll come back to the exchange in a minute five. Final segment on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about life in the Peace Corps as experienced by Ashland residents Asifa Kanji and David Drury. They wrote their thoughts down and turned what they wrote down into a memoir, actually two memoirs, but sharing a single set of covers. 300 Cups of Tea is Asifa's memoir of her Peace Corps time in Mali. The Toughest Job is David's memoir. They're in one book put out by Drury & Sons Publishers. What do you know? D. Drury & Sons Publishers, which I assume is David. We'll talk more about what's in the book in just a moment. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. If you have some questions or comments for our guests or some experiences of your own to share, perhaps in the Peace Corps, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When I was asking about the rhythm of work, it was more about how you got into the details of your job and all that sort of thing. And I think we got a fair amount of that from you, David. Asifa, talk about the work you did. We haven't heard much about that so far.
Well, I was assigned to a health clinic, particularly a women's health clinic. And one of the assignments I had was to help reduce malnutrition in the area. Now, this is a clinic where women bring their children to be immunized. There is a doctor present, so if children are sick or women are sick, that's where they would come. And my job specifically was to work with the mothers and the nurses to help educate them, to keep them breastfeeding their children, because believe it or not, only 40% of mothers in Mali breastfeed their children continuously for at least the first 6 months.
And why? I was curious about that.
I don't have a really good answer. It was a question I kept asking that, you know, you've been producing children, seven of them on average per woman. And how come some of these basic skills of child raising don't come down the family? And the only answer I got was that with 50, 60 years of development, Western cultures coming in, I don't know whether it's an apology or out of guilt of we should do something for these people that, you know, basically got colonized for years and years, their lands got taken away. So they say that first families started breaking down when the lands got taken away for farming. The French did that in terms of the cotton fields and stuff. So that broke up the dynamics of how a family works together. Then secondly, with development, you've got all kinds of aid people, health and otherwise, who come in, and they come in with their latest theory. And at one point, Nestle's got involved because they wanted to promote their powdered milk.
The formula, yeah.
The formula. And so they were discouraging people to breastfeed their kids or their babies and to feed formula. Of course, they don't have money to buy formula. It gets watered down. The water is not treated. And so that creates its own set of problems. I don't really have a good reason other than what people said that, well, you know, they keep telling us, don't do this. Now do try this. And now it's back to go back to breastfeeding your children. So it's a mess in terms of confusion. People are not literate. They're very poor. The women work extraordinarily hard. They're out in the fields all day. Remember, no electricity, no running water, so washing clothes or even fetching water is a major task, depending on how far the river or the well is. They're raising their children. They do all the work. They really do. And so there is a shortage of time.
The men drink cups of tea. Mm-hmm. The men drink cups of tea? The men
drink lots of cups of tea.
The men and not the women?
Actually, they both do. But okay. The stereotype is the men, when it's not really high season in agriculture, will sit around and spend large swaths of their day chatting and drinking many cups of tea.
Mm-hmm. In the culture then where there is poverty, there is hardship, daily living takes a bit more work than we're used to getting, where you flick light switches and you turn knobs and water comes out. Given that, I mean, and the high illiteracy rate, do the things that you teach them not stick? I mean, because they're still dealing with all the other things that are in their daily lives?
Yes, and part of being a Peace Corps volunteer and part of the training you receive from Peace Corps and your own life's experiences, how do you make something sustainable? And that was a major, major issue. So one of the projects that I worked on was moringa. Moringa is this miracle tree whose leaves contain incredible amounts of nutrition. It's a complete protein. It has all the amino acids plus all the micro, macro nutrients in there. And I would tell people about it and they'd get very excited. Oh, this is great. Give me, you know, do you have a plant? Where do we get it from? And ultimately, I found that the ones that I gave away individually died or the animals ate it. And the women are really way, way too busy to nurture this one little plant. And so in thinking about it, how do we make this sustainable? The answer came with a group of women who really cared and did want to make this work. And we went to the head of the clinic to say, would he donate a piece of land at the clinic? And once we had this public nursery that was fenced in, the interest started going up. And one of the conditions was we are going to meet every 2 weeks for the rest of the year. So I was with them the whole time. And we'd talk about nutrition. We'd talk about malaria. We'd talk about all kinds of things. They'd also bring their babies in and they'd weigh their babies. We'd make up porridge with moringa in it, which they'd feed. They'd also take them home so there was enough food for the children. And one of the things that happened, 7, 8, 9 weeks into the project, one of the ladies came and said, look, my baby is beginning to look like an American baby, you know, nice and plump and animated. And so other women started to take notice. One of the things that moringa also does is it stimulates the mammary glands, and so the milk flows a lot easier. And the women started noticing that. They also noticed that their skin got better. One woman had acne. She said, this powder you're giving me, it's magic. It's making my skin and my hair more beautiful. Well, the moment you talk about making women more beautiful, every woman wants in. And that was part of it. And, of course, they want their children to be healthy, too. So we started getting people who wanted to join. And what happened was the group of women I was working with, they took on the responsibility of creating groups like the one I had created, and they in turn would work with the groups over the next 11 months of planting, growing moringa, using it, eating it, and selling it because money is important.
So you were able to set up a system where people would embrace what you were doing and continue it on, and it wouldn't just...
Well, unfortunately, that was right on the cusp of that happening when the women, when we started getting many more villages and women interested in the project, was when the coup happened. So I can't tell you where the project is right now or what has happened because I have no way of communicating with them.
So tell us about the coup and what you two went through in knowing what was going on around you and in finally getting out of the country.
Well, we had two very different stories for that as well. Just absolutely by chance, on the day of the coup, the day before the coup, Asifa had got a call from Peace Corps saying, your aunt in London, a very beloved aunt, was dying. So I put her on the bus to Bamako, and through, and it's a good story in the book, it's called The Last Plane Out of Bamako. Asifa makes it onto the last plane that left the airport before the coup. Of course, I stayed behind, and I woke up to the sound of gunfire all over town.
Oh, boy. And then what?
Well, it was mostly soldiers firing in the air because it was a done deal. They were celebrating. But the junta, which took over the elected government, they alienated all of Mali's neighbors who closed the borders. And nothing could get in or out, including gasoline. So Peace Corps in Washington and Bamako started thinking, what if we can't get the volunteers out? And that's when they decided to evacuate. So we had pretty much, it was several days after the coup, and we got that dreaded call, pack one bag, be at the Dodge House, the local Peace Corps house, tomorrow morning, or out of here.
Hmm.
It was very sad. And so, like Asifa, we never had a chance to say goodbye and to say thank you. Unlike Asifa, the people I worked with have internet. It's a radio and cyber
right,
cafe.
Sure.
So I'm still in touch with the people there. And one of the things that makes me happy is that many of the things that we had talked about and strategized, they're doing now.
Would you recommend Peace Corps service to anybody?
With people with some brains and a lot of courage, yes. I would not say it's comfortable, but it's immensely rewarding.
Mm-hmm. The toughest job, but you did love it, it sounds like.
We loved it.
And how do people, you were trying to tell me during the break about Peace Corps in this area.
Well, there are two things. There is a returned Peace Corps volunteers group. Volunteers may know that all over the country there are affiliates of the National Peace Corps Association, and there is one here. In fact, if people want to get in touch with them, just go on the net to www.facebook.com/SouthernOregonReturnedPeaceCorpsVolunteers, one very long word, and that will take you onto their webpage where you can get an email address and a phone number.
All right, so just if you type into a Google, for example, Southern Oregon Returned Peace Corps Volunteers and Facebook, it should get you to
You'll get
page.
It. You'll get it.
All right.
And for SOU students especially, there is a campus ambassador program where there is a student who works very closely with Peace Corps recruiters, sets up events, gives out information, and that has just started this year. It's a new program there, and anyone who wants to get in touch, the guy's name is Ryan, and you can get, and their address is soupeacecorps@gmail.com. They don't have a web page right now, soupeacecorps@gmail.com.
Okay, and now do I see that I have you an event at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland on Monday?
We do indeed. We're going to be reading from the book from 7 to 8 on Monday.
All right, great to have you here. 300 Cups of Tea is David Drury's memoir. 300 Cups of Tea is Asifa Kanji's memoir. The Toughest Job is David Drury's memoir inside one single set of covers. And as we pointed out by D. Drury and Sons Publishers, I want to thank Asifa and David for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, take care.